good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Noel Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And we invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for over 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press. And he has authored more than 60 publications on birding, probably up to about 70 now. And he and his wife and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks for serving as our expert once again tonight.
Hey, Bill, thank you.
So again, if you have questions tonight about our bird world, the avian world, or anything that Cliff can answer dealing with ornithology, give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And if you'd like to send photos in tonight that Cliff can identify, you can send them to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Cliff, at the end of last month, you gave us a conservation tip, and can you refresh our memories about that this month?
Yeah, we talked about nuisance woodpeckers. Now, I don't know that woodpeckers could ever be a nuisance to me, but they can be to some people. So nuisance is a perspective.
It depends on the time of the morning.
That's right. But I have seen the damage that they can do to property, and I can agree that it is a nuisance. Luckily, I've never had such damage to my property of any kind, but what we talked about was when they're drumming, which is that rapping sound like a brrr, they're usually just doing that on a metal gutter or metal roof or a pole, and they're doing that to communicate to other woodpeckers. But the nuisance really comes when they excavate, meaning they chisel away the wood and make holes in the side of your house or your barn or your tool shed or in your telephone pole, and that's a problem. And I've worked with several landowners, homeowners, who've resorted to shooting woodpeckers, which is not a legal activity, but they didn't feel like they had any other resort or recourse. But what happened was they'd remove these woodpeckers to find new ones would move in and do the same thing. And it was mostly because they had a house that was just perfect for woodpeckers. Cedar siding is good. Brown is good. You know, when you'd stand back and think like a woodpecker and look at your house and say, yeah, it does look like a big tree, then guess what? It's pretty attractive to a woodpecker. So there are blueprints on the Parks and Wildlife website that tell you how to build a cavity box or a nest box for woodpeckers, because that's what they're doing in most of these cases. When it's a hole that looks like a cannon went through and your fist could go through it, that's not excavating for food. That's excavating to try to make a roost cavity or nest cavity. And often what they do is they don't like what they find after they've excavated through the outer wood. They you know, hit insulation or maybe even get through that and get to sheetrock and then peek into the house. They don't want that. Yeah. So they'll move over a few feet to the side and start over. And that's when it's a problem, when you have several of these holes in the house. And so when they're trying to make a roost or nest cavity, why don't you appease them, put up a nest box that's the right size for the woodpecker that's causing this damage, and put it up on the house. It's cheap. It's kind of cool. You'll have a conversation piece when family or friends come over. And the woodpeckers usually take to it because they're wasting a lot of time excavating for nothing. So they're looking for a cozy cavity to sleep in at night or to raise young in. But it's usually a winter and fall thing. Fall and winter thing when migratory flickers come down is a big issue, and they'll do that. But also resident pileateds and resident red-bellied woodpeckers are a big problem too. So it's a conservation tip, because if people are resorting to shooting birds, that's not going to help. And we don't need to lose these woodpeckers, especially if you're going to find out that they're coming back. I'm not going to mention the people's names in East Texas that I worked with 20 years ago on this. They had shot 17 different pileated woodpeckers before they just gave up, and they had tried everything. Owl decoys, rubber snakes. Someone even told them about putting paint on the house that has pepper spray. Well, the woodpeckers are not tasting the wood. They're not eating it. It didn't work. The last resort, someone told them to put up vinyl siding, and it was going to be something like $40,000 on this massive house. Mm. And my solution was about $300, and it worked. And it has worked for many other people to put up these boxes to keep them from excavating these cannon-sized holes in the side of your house. So hopefully if people have woodpeckers and they have the nuisance kind that are doing this, they can go on the website, Parks and Wildlife website, and look for a booklet called Woodpecker Damage, A Simple Solution, and that will give them some blueprints that will help them out.
Yep. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he's ready to take your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now. And as always, we have a spotlight that we're going to look at this month. What do we've got for a bird spotlight this month?
Yep, we profile a different bird each episode. This one I'm pretty excited about because it's something I think we're all familiar with. We're going to talk about the wild turkey, not the alcohol, but the feathered guy. And I think most people are familiar with the turkey's gobble, as we hear right here. Let's listen again to the gobble. And there are several other calls, like the yelp call.
And that's the one you hear them with the decoy sound,
yep,
when they're
the sound
trying
box
to draw them in.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, that's the yelp call. It's usually a hen doing that. And in addition to those two calls, there are several other calls that are emitted by the wild turkey, including the putt, the purr, the cluck, the cut, and the assembly call. There are a whole bunch that have been named. The wild turkey is a native species to North America, and it's a popular game bird. It's so popular that the nonprofit conservation education organization called the National Wild Turkey Federation, which is headquartered in Edgefield, South Carolina, has more than 250,000 members, which is incredible and fantastic. That means there's a lot of people interested in turkeys. The only other member in the family is the oscillated turkey, which is found in southeast Mexico to Guatemala and Belize. Turkey hunters that you mentioned using that box call, they attempt to mimic many of the turkey's calls in order to lure in a gobbler, but a common way to locate turkeys is also to imitate the calls of a crow or a barred owl, but even a car horn or a sound of slamming a car door might get a nearby turkey to gobble. There are 6 different recognized subspecies of the wild turkey throughout its range, which it has a pretty tremendous range in the U.S. Here's an interesting fact that Benjamin Franklin, he lobbied hard to make this feisty species as our national bird instead of the bald eagle, because he noted that the eagle was unworthy since it often stole fish from osprey and ate carrion. So he was a big proponent of having the wild turkey as our national bird, which obviously didn't work. In the end, the adult male is known as a tom, the female is a hen, and the young male is a jake, and the little guys are known as poults. So there's lots of different names that you'll hear about when you talk to people about turkeys. The male on average weighs about upwards of 24 pounds, but there are individuals on the record books that are over 30 pounds, and that's not rare. And this is wild and wary birds. These are not domesticated birds. Those domesticated birds typically get a lot bigger because they're just sitting around like couch potatoes, when the truly wild ones have to earn a living, and they get a pretty good workout doing so. There are not many other birds in the U.S. that are heavier than a turkey. Some of those include the trumpeter swan, the tundra swan, the white pelican, the condor, and the whooping crane are heavier, but that's about it. This is a big, chunky bird. Turkeys prefer forests and savannas with scattered openings with plenty of native grass. They're also in the near impenetrable scrub of the South Texas brushlands that it does include grassy openings. Turkeys are omnivorous. They feed on the ground, but they roost up in trees at night. Acorns and other mast are important for turkeys in fall and winter. Large insects like grasshoppers found in grassy areas are important for young turkeys. The males are polygamous, and they strut to grab the attention of the females. And once mated, the nest is tended only by the hen. She places that in a shallow depression in the dirt, often under a woody shrub or other thick cover. She lays a clutch of 10 to 14 eggs, and they take about 28 days to incubate. The young are precocial, and they leave the nest within about 24 hours of hatching. So that's pretty neat that within 24 hours that bird gets out of the egg and then runs around following mom. A lot of ducks do that too. There are a lot of birds that are precocial, but when we think of a lot of our songbirds, they're altricial. They stay in the nest for a good long while as they develop. Because they're so tasty, turkeys have numerous predators of the eggs, the poults, and the adults. Species that like to eat them are things like raccoons, opossums, and skunks, rat snakes, raptors, bobcats, coyotes, and others. They all enjoy feasting on turkeys. The former reduction in turkey numbers was due to unregulated market hunting, but more recent range reductions are due to habitat loss, especially in East Texas where I live. When I used to visit the open longleaf pine forest of the Vernon Ranger District of the Coosatchee National Forest near Leesville, Louisiana, an area that's maintained with regular prescribed fire. That area used to be a great stronghold for wild turkeys in our Red River Radio listening area. But today, most counties and parishes in our listening area have seen, sadly, a complete extirpation of this species, mainly due to habitat loss, habitat alterations, things like fire suppression, and loss of native grasses and forbs. So that's quite unfortunate because that's such a cool bird.
Yes, it is. And I wonder how that would affect at Thanksgiving had it become the national bird. Because I can't imagine having a turkey dinner of your national
bird. That's
right. That would have been an interesting, but it didn't happen that way. So.
Maybe we would have eaten the bald eagle instead. How about that?
Not as tasty.
Probably not.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Please give us a call tonight at 800-552-8500. With your questions about our avian world, that's 800-552-8502. And up next, we do have a submitted bit of audio from a listener over in Texas. And she said, after listening to your last show on the red-bellied woodpecker, I'm now questioning the call on a video audio piece that she sent in. We've got the audio up. She says, I want it to be the pileated woodpecker, but what do you think? And this video was taken in southeast Dallas County this week, and where she has also seen red-bellied pileated and northern flickers there. Carrie Robinson is the person who submitted this. Let's take a listen.
Yep, that's indeed the pileated, and I grew up in Dallas County, and that's a fantastic find. That's getting pretty far west for that bird. They do, you know, trickle up any of the wooded tributaries of the Trinity River. The old sewage ponds that were in South Dallas, that was always a good spot to try to find that bird, but it wasn't expected, wasn't regular, but that's the cluck, cluck, cluck sound of the pileated woodpecker. That's usually when they're upset with something and they're making that vocalization. So she's correct, it is a pileated woodpecker, and we did profile it, one of its cousins, the red-bellied, which sounds very different. So
right, exactly.
that's a good, not only a cool recording, a neat sound, but in the location she took it was really nice, because where I live in Nacogdoches, they're expected, they're in my backyard all the time. Here in Shreveport, you know, they're expected, they're all over the place.
I've heard them in my apartment complex.
Yep. So But Dallas County, that's getting west of the Big Woods where they really occur. So that's pretty neat.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go to our first caller tonight, Nicholas from East Texas. You're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Yes, I had a question about the rose-breasted grosbeak.
Okay.
I see them twice a year out here, normally in East Texas. I'm out here near the Angelina National Forest. And I haven't seen them this year. And I was wondering if you have a bird count on or if you've observed them and, like, what they're up to. It's one of my favorite birds.
Okay. Yeah, it's the rose-breasted grosbeak. And it's
grosbeak.
Yep, grosbeak.
Yeah, in Louisiana, we say grosbeak.
Well, the grosbeak is different than the grosbeak. So that's a different species altogether. But the rose-breasted grosbeak is purely a migrant in our listening area. It does not winter here, and it does not summer and breed with us. So they're only in passage and migration. And typically when people see them in the listening area is in spring, April and May, when they come to your seed feeder. So
yeah.
And also if you have a mulberry tree that's fruiting, when the berries are, you know, dark purple, you can see grosbeaks just gorging on that purple. And people often say, you know, the beak doesn't match the color in the book because, man, if you look, it's dark purple. Well, it's juice. It's like when you go to a family feast and you've got food all over your face, that's exactly what people are seeing. But the beak is usually very pale in color, and unless he's
gorging
in something juicy that's running down his beak.
A little blueberry pie.
Right.
I know that.
Yeah. So I think if you want to see one, it's going to be all pretty much luck. You're going to have to probably quit your job and stay home during migration and watch your feeder and maybe plant a mulberry tree. And you got to wait several years before he starts producing berries. But otherwise, it's a matter of chance and luck to see
one.
Yeah,
I usually see a flock of about 10 of them. They come to my house once a year.
Oh, wow.
So they stay for at least 3 or 4 days.
Okay.
I don't exaggerate.
Wow. Well, that's a pretty good flock. I usually don't see numbers like that inland.
Maybe it's because of where I'm at. I'm along the river.
Yeah, maybe so.
They're following.
Right. So I think maybe get geared up for April, May. I would say the middle of April for the next three-ish weeks is really a good peak time for that bird to be pouring through. And they're headed north. Those rose-breasted grosbeaks are trying to get to points farther north, like maybe Minnesota and Wisconsin, where they'll breed.
Oh, so I'm helping them out, giving them a little boost.
Yeah, you're a gas station along the way that they need to refuel. But it's a great bird. So thank
you. I love it.
Yeah, thanks,
thank
Nicholas.
You so much.
Yep, thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have several calls online. Bridget and Marshall, you are on hold right now. We're going to go next to William from, I guess it's Magnolia. And William, you're online next. What's your question?
Well, my question is, I don't have a problem with woodpeckers. I'd like to trust more of them. But how can I do that? We talked about building some kind of box. Can you build that just to attract them?
Yeah, you can do that to attract them. Now there's a lot of other critters that'll use them. So if you build big ones for pileated woodpeckers, you might get a squirrel. There are a lot of other critters that want that same real estate. So what I recommend in your case, if you don't have a problem with them and you know they're wanting to nest in that one very spot, and yet you just want to attract them, I would say put up multiple boxes of various sizes. So the medium sized box for the red-bellied woodpecker or red-headed woodpecker, and the large one for the pileated. And those are mentioned in that booklet on the Parks and Life website that I mentioned earlier.
Okay, now what website is that?
Go to Texas Parks and Wildlife, or just go to Google and put in Texas Parks and Wildlife woodpecker damage, and it should pop up. And in that booklet, it's only, I don't know, 12 or 16 pages long. It'll have blueprints towards the back on what how to build it, you know, because the diameter of the hole has to be so much. You know, a lot of these birds are like Goldilocks, and if you don't have it just right, they won't take to it. But like I said, you got other critters wanting to use it, but that's kind of cool. I know people that have put up boxes for birds, and they've gotten flying squirrels instead, and that's really cool to be there at dusk and after dark when the porch light's on and watch the flying squirrels come out and glide around. So it's just neat to put them up and see what you get. And so hopefully you can do that, William.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you, William. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds or our avian world is fair game. And we go next to Bridget from Nacogdoches. Bridget, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. I have a question. We have seen a couple of families of turkeys around our place, about 200 acres of pine plantations. I was wondering if there's anything that we can plant. What is their native diet? What does that consist of that we might be able to help keep those turkeys there in that area?
Well, I think one of the big things is if you've got woods with hardwoods that have mast like acorns, is to leave them alone. Leave the trees, let them get mature. That provides a lot of the food for fall and winter. If you've got openings in grass areas, moving back to native grasses would really help too. Instead of these monocultures of non-native grass that we either mow too low or graze, that's not going to help. So they need fairly tall, lush mix of grasses and forbs where you have grasshoppers that are in there, and that's where the hen will bring her poults in after the breeding season when they're young, and they'll feast on those grasshoppers. There's a lot of moisture, a lot of protein, and that really helps these poults grow to maturity. So the neat thing about the turkey is it needs a variety of habitats, and that's why I like talking about it with conservation-minded people, because it's not one small thing you can do. It's several big things you have to do. And it's sort of an umbrella species. If you do good things for the turkey, there are going to be a whole lot of other things that you're going to benefit. Okay?
Right. We noticed them on our deer cameras that we saw some turkeys eating the corn. Is that something good to do for them year-round or just in the winter?
Well,
Is that good or is that not good?
There's nothing you can do. If you're putting out deer corn, they're going to come to it. Everybody likes free food. The problem is when you read the reports and the studies about aflatoxin,
right,
which is a fungus on seed and corn when it gets hot and sweaty. We're in the deep south where that food gets hot and sweaty, and it produces something called aflatoxin, and it can be lethal in certain doses to a lot of species. The smaller birds like cardinal, it's going to be more susceptible. I'm not sure exactly how aflatoxin affects wild turkey, but you know, the tainted seed is a problem. It's not something you can see or smell often. It's just something you put out, it happens, and it's all too late. And sometimes we don't know. It's not easy to look at a dead bird and say, oh, that was a tainted seed with aflatoxin that did it. I mean, you have to run pretty rigorous tests to do that, and they're usually not very conclusive.
Okay. Does the prescribed burning, is that helpful or not helpful? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, the prescribed burning or fire, the lack of fire in general in our listening area has been a problem for a lot of species, and that would be prescribed fire of native grasses and forbs. There are a whole bunch of birds that are all declining because of they live in that area from knee level down. Things like the northern bobwhite, Bachman sparrow, wild turkey. These critters need that lush grassy understory, but it's maintained with fire, because otherwise you've got woody pioneering species that want to come in and shade out the grasses and take over. So prescribed fire is good. You know, there are people that say, well, I don't want to burn up the turkey nest, so I'm not going to burn. Well, you're actually doing more harm if you look at long term, because you might be benefiting the turkey for the next couple years, but once that woody stuff moves in and it shifts from a grassland to a shrubby, scrubby old field and even more to forest, and you quit burning, you've just eliminated turkeys.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's been very helpful.
Good. Thank you, Bridget.
Thank you, Bridget. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we're going to go next to Marshall, and Lawrence is after that. But first, we do have a call-in question very quickly. Andy from Jasper, didn't want to go on the air, but did want to ask a question. Do wild parakeets live in the East Texas area?
Wild parakeets, well, historically they did. There were Carolina parakeets throughout the eastern third of Texas and parts of Louisiana, and they've been gone for, 80 years, 90 years or so from our area. There are monk parakeets that have been released in some cities. I saw a pair in Jacksonville, Texas, of all places, sitting on a wire in the middle of the city of Jacksonville. That's been 10, 12 years ago, but I think they can pop up anywhere. If you go to other cities like Austin, there's a really healthy population of monk parakeets, but that's a non-native. It's not native to this area. It's actually native to temperate South America. I think we talked about it in the last episode, that species, but the answer is monk parakeet is possible, but it is not native. And I don't know any area in the East Texas area where there are lots of them. You have to go to Houston or Austin or Dallas to find them. They're very urbanized.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. If you'd like to give us a question tonight, our phone lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Marshall from Longview, Texas. Marshall, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes. I had been listening to you talking about the woodpeckers, and it made me think of my mother's bird feeders growing up in Cass County, and we had lots of brown-headed cowbirds and red-winged blackbirds. Any way to discourage them from coming to the bird feeders where we're trying to attract cardinals and a lot of the little sparrows and other things?
Yeah, that's a tough one. There are feeders that exclude squirrels because they're heavier than these birds, but it's really tough to exclude some of these birds you're mentioning. I think one of the things you can do is not do hen scratch or any mixed bird seed that has millet in it. If you go to straight black oil sunflower, that can usually eliminate a big problem with cowbirds and redwings. So changing the seed is the first step and the only step I'm going to recommend. So again, move to black oil sunflower and see how that helps. Okay.
All right. Would that eliminate some of the other little small sparrows or thrushes?
It'll attract the little guys like chipping sparrows, white-throated sparrows, American goldfinch, purple finch, cardinals, tufted titmice, two or three species of nuthatch. It actually opens the door for a lot more of the songbirds that you and I might agree as being more desirable. Okay?
All right. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Marshall.
All right. Thank you, Marshall. And you are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio. If you'd like to give us a call, you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. We have phone lines open. That's 800-552-8502. We've got Neil on hold right now. Lawrence from East Texas, you're online next with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's a small brown falcon. I know a falcon when I see one. It's bigger than a kestrel, I think. But it's in the middle of these deep woods, sometimes flying about no more than 2 feet off the ground. And daughter has, I've seen it three times. Like I said, I'm surrounded by nothing but national forest.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter says that there is such a thing as a forest falcon.
Mm-hmm.
And what am I seeing? I've seen it three times. She's seen it at least once or twice.
Right. Well, all the true forest falcons are in the tropics, and there aren't any of them in your area. So there's maybe two records in the valley. They're super rare, and you have to go to really southern Tamaulipas, Mexico, before you can pick up the collared forest falcon. That's the species where we have two records in the maybe three. It's large. It's bigger than a crow, and it's very white underneath, and it's not going to be the bird you're seeing. So just because it's a raptor in the forest, it makes sense to call it a forest falcon, but it's not. It's not a falcon either, because falcons, the next size falcon of kestrel is a merlin, and
right.
That's a bird of open country. They don't fly in the woods.
Right.
So the bird that I'm guessing that you're seeing is a sharp-shinned hawk. Or maybe a Cooper's hawk, and they both fly in the forest. They're chasing birds like a falcon, and they do the woods. They can maneuver in the woods. Their wings are short and rounded. Their tail is long, so they can maneuver through canopies and under trees and through the brush. And I saw one in my yard this winter just dive in some azalea bushes where a bunch of white-throated sparrows were, and I could see him running around on the ground, which was
right.
Really cool to see. So I, without seeing what you're seeing, I would bet my 401k that you've got a sharp-shinned or Cooper's hawk.
That's too small for Cooper's, but I mean, the sharp-shinned is the smaller of those two, isn't it?
It is, but there's some variation by gender. So the female sharp-shinned is larger than the male, so she's pretty good size. She'll take a white-winged dove.
Is the sharp-shinned brown?
The young ones are brown, yes. The adults are fairly silvery gray. So an immature sharp-shinned hawk would be brown, and they are on their own. Right now, they're feeding by themselves, and that would be what I would bet you have.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, very good.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have phone lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning birds, birding, or our avian world, it's fair game. And we go next to Neil Johnson right here in Shreveport. Neil, what's your question tonight?
Let's switch to owls.
All right.
Everybody loves owls.
Everybody gives a hoot.
Yeah, that's it. And my wife's a coyote, and they love their owls.
Oh, yeah.
But I had an owl event where I walked out the door to go get the paper in the dark one morning, a few months ago, and I heard what sounded like a furry animal, like it sounded like a growl, and I walked farther and found the source of it, which was a large owl sitting up in a tree silhouetted against the sky. And while I was looking at that and being amazed at it, here comes a second one swooping in silently to sit next to him on the branch.
Oh, neat.
And I think they talked a little bit, but then they each flew off in their own way.
Right.
But what kind of owl would that have been that sounds like a growl? I mean, we hear the hoot, and that's a barn owl, isn't it?
The barred owl.
Ooh.
Yeah,
barred.
The barred owl, B-A-R-R-E-D, makes a very loud hoot.
Yeah.
But the great horned is a master of several different calls. And here's one Bill's firing up that we played recently. That's not a deep growl like
That's a screech. That's kind of a screech there.
That's not the growl, but here's the hooting.
And we hear that.
Yeah.
In our neighborhood often.
So I'm guessing the growl is just a contact call that you witnessed, and I don't know if that I've heard it before, and actually we might not even agree on what it sounds like. So what I'm going to do, Neil, is give you a homework assignment, and I want you
good.
To record it, in hopes that...
I wish I had recorded that one, because it was fairly loud.
Yeah, and you got...
Take your phone out.
you know what? Yep. Your paper, you said you want to get the paper. I bet you get it daily. And
yep,
that means you got to make this walk daily, and you can have your cell phone fired up and ready.
There you go. There you go.
And just have it on video, and don't worry about it capturing any images. You want the video to capture the sound, and then you
Well, it's got a good sound microphone on here.
And then you can send it
but
in.
But I had never heard that. That's what it was so unusual. And then I got a visual on it, which was very, very special.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. Well, that's cool. I mean, that's better than reading the paper right there, I'll tell you what.
Okay, well, thank you guys.
Okay, thanks, Neil.
Thanks, Neil. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have all lines open right now, so you can get your question in right away at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 8502. Now, Cliff, back in December, they did the Christmas bird count, and we kind of like a wrap up of that. How did we fare this year? Was it a good year for birds in our area?
Well, you know, if you the two counts I did, there are multiple counts during about a 3-week period. In Texas, there are 110 different Christmas counts. The two I did, they just happened to be on two of the coldest days of the year. They were about, well, they were actually back-to-back. It was that Sunday, Monday, maybe the 14th, 15th, I think, of December. And, I mean, I froze. And the first one was in Nacogdoches, and the second one was down in Matagorda County on the Texas coast near Bay City. And I had, that one was brutal because not only was it in the 20s, but I had to, the crew I worked with, I had to get on an airboat, and two college buddies of mine and I, we do this route. One of my buddies, Mark, is he's the airboat captain, and so he's always looking for helpers. And so for the last 3 or 4 years, myself and a mutual buddy, we get on an airboat with him, and it was brutal being up, you know, on top of the boat, no windshield. I don't think I've ever worn double skull cap, wool cap before, and I needed it. I've been to, you know, parts of the north when it's freezing. I've been up in the Rocky Mountains when it's freezing, and I've never been this cold. So that really affects the birding. It's hard to get birds to be active sometimes when it's really cold, and it's hard to hold your binoculars.
Hard
when
to
you're
get
shaking.
Me active when it's really cold.
Yeah. So, but there were other counts that did pretty well. I mean, gosh, after that cold snap, then we were back in shorts and t-shirts.
Right, that was our winter there. Yeah. We've had two of them, two-day winters.
That's
so far,
right.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting after all the numbers are analyzed. I'm going to guess that continentally it didn't get, other than those cold snaps, it didn't get cold enough to push a lot of goldfinches and siskins down. So I'm going to guess that those birds are going to be low because it just, there's not a trigger. If it's cold for 3 days, a lot of birds can hang. It needs to be cold for 7-10 days farther north to really push birds out of there and come down here where it's mild. So it's hard to know what a lot of these birds are doing at this moment, but I think we'll have some reports in the coming months that'll tell us how the count did,
especially after the ice storm that has been hitting. That might be sending a few down our way.
Yeah, that would help. But I think the neat thing about the Christmas bird count, it's been going on for over a century, and it doesn't matter. It's like the postal service. It doesn't matter if it's raining or sleeting or snowing. You've got to deliver. And so as a volunteer or as a bird watcher that is interested in helping, you do it no matter how cold it is. And after 100 years, we have some pretty interesting trend data.
Right.
We can see when things have fallen off and when things have increased. So it gives us a nice trend, and it's fun to participate in. So hopefully next year people can get involved in the Christmas bird count.
Yep. There you go. And you can find out about those by contacting your local Audubon Society. Yep. They'd have that information.
Right.
Or your local conservation office.
Right. Or go online and just Google National Audubon Society's Christmas bird count, and that'll take you to their website, which is a little difficult to navigate. But if you just, you know, focus a little bit and dig deep, you can find a Christmas count near you and who to contact, because you want to find that compiler that will put you to work and tell you where to go or hook you up with maybe a party that needs extra bodies that have experts, and you can learn from those folks. So there's a lot more to the Christmas count than just counting birds. You can learn a lot. You can meet people with same interests as you. But the contributing to what we call citizen science is probably the number one thing of the Christmas count.
It's a good way to get involved and also to learn about the scientific process if you're not trained in that in your own background.
That's right.
You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. We're going to go next to Mike from Hallsville, Texas. Mike, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
I was wondering how many species of bird can actually mimic human speech.
How many birds can mimic human speech? Oh, nothing wild in our area. So a lot of the cage birds, like a yellow-headed Amazon, a crested myna. There's several Amazons or parrots that do it. There's that myna. And, the African gray parrot's a great one. But other than parrots and mynas, you're talking about imitating a human voice. In other words, Polly wants a cracker, right? Is that what you're asking, Mike?
Well, more or less. My main question was, as I had heard at one point, that crows can actually speak.
Yeah, and I think we talked about that in a last episode or two. There was a crow that was injured that was in the Heard Museum in McKinney, Texas, that the caretaker taught it to say, oh boy, and it was just perfect, like a, I don't know, had kind of the tone of a little grandma, 85-year-old lady, sweet voice that just said, oh boy. So I didn't mention that, crows, but I don't think you're going to find a wild crow doing it. This one was in a cage. He had a broken wing. He was around humans for 24/7, and it imprinted on him. So that's, I think it's only going to be things in cages that are going to be mimicking the human voice. How about that?
Great. Thank you very
much. Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. I'm always curious, how about a mockingbird?
Well, mockingbirds mimic, but they mimic other bird sounds. They'll mimic a car alarm, a squeaky gate, but not, hey, Polly wants a cracker. They're not going to talk.
I'm going to sit out and talk to mine and see if I can get him to mimic me. So.
Well, good luck.
Right. Well, I can listen to music and do that.
Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 with any question concerning our avian world or birding. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Mark from Shreveport. Mark, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Thanks. I want to say it was about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, and my office window looked out towards downtown Shreveport, and not quite into downtown, but just south of downtown, and I would get distracted by these soaring raptors that I could not identify. The description that I have is the underwing had a black and white pattern, I would say, kind of the reverse of a buzzard. Very high soaring. There was a nesting pair that were in the tall stand of trees nearby, and the closest thing I could come to was maybe a Mississippi kite, the swallowtail. I never saw a manifest, so I don't think it was a swallowtail, or possibly a Swainson's hawk.
No,
a possibility.
I think you nailed it on your first guess. On your first guess, so you win the prize. I think that you nailed it. So a swallowtail kite is, there's nothing else like it, with that black and white tuxedo look, and that graceful flying with that long scissor tail. A Swainson's hawk is a big chunky bird. It's got a lot of barred tail, and that's not going to be in the city. That's going to be out in the open prairie, but there are lots of Mississippi kites that are in the entire Red River drainage from west of Wichita Falls in Texas, and all along, all the way until it reaches the Chafalaya Basin. There are tons, and the Mississippi River itself. there are tons of Mississippi kites. So that's what I'm betting, and you knew it too. It was your first pick, which is good, Mark. So they're aerial acrobats. I'm sure you noticed that they make flight look super easy.
And, oh, yeah.
And yeah, they're hawking insects, so they're eating dragonflies and grasshoppers that are flying up high, and you can't really often see what they're eating, but they're flying around catching these things and eating them on the wing, and that's pretty cool that you can look out your office window. Does your supervisor know that you're watching birds out your window during the work hours?
Well, luckily we moved locations. They aren't distracting, but they were just, it was just a perfect view.
Yeah.
Third floor access. And I've always been interested in hawks and all kinds of raptors. I hadn't quite seen those markings, and the soaring that they were doing was pretty impressive.
That's pretty neat. That's cool that you had to see that. So what do you see out your window now?
I really don't look out my window.
Oh, okay. Nothing cool to see.
There's a dumpster on the other side.
Man. That's no good.
But I appreciate it because I couldn't do the kite. Mississippi kite have different age, I guess, plumage patterns.
Yeah, you'll see.
But that's what was throwing me off. Yeah. I couldn't quite find a picture that looked just like the one that I saw.
Well, and they just, you know, you mentioned dark. They in the right light, they look pretty dark, and they have some white in the wing, on the trailing edge of the wing, that really contrast with the rest of the bird. But if you look at most pictures, they show them as a kind of a slaty gray, but in cloudy days when the sun's not out or they're banking just right, they can look really dark above. So it is a tough bird to match with a book, especially when the book shows it perched, when most of the time we see Mississippi kites, they're aloft and flying, and so everything you described, and especially the location, it's just 100% leading to Mississippi kite. So I think we're good on that one.
Okay.
Cool.
Well, definitely appreciate it.
Okay. Keep watching out your window.
All right. Thank you, Mark, for calling in. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have all lines open right now. It's still time in our show, so go ahead and give us a call with your question about our birding world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We did have one online question. The caller asks, wants to know why the blue jay population fluctuates in this area.
Well, on an annual basis, that's good. That person is very observant and notices that blue jays get into larger numbers here in the colder months. And that's because we have winter birds from the north that come and join our resident birds. So, you know, if you're looking for big numbers of blue jays, the hotter months, we have the least amount, because those birds that breed in Missouri and other points farther south, they go back up north. I don't even know. We don't have a lot of banding data to tell us where a lot of these blue jays are coming from. But we have a whole bunch of birds that do that, where we have larger numbers of individuals during part of the year. And the blue jay is a great example. Another one is a brown thrasher, red-tailed hawk, northern flicker. These are all birds that we get a lot of the northern birds in the winter because we're so mild. But otherwise, we do have resident birds that stay year-round. But if you're looking for any of those I listed in the hotter months, they're not as easy to find. I mean, you still find a lot of blue jays because they like your city limits, but flickers are pretty tough to find in the nesting season, but they are not tough to find around the last few days of September into about October 10th is when they just flood our area, and they're with us for the next several months. Same thing with red-tailed hawks, and you see that on the highways when you drive around. During the colder months, you'll see a ton of red-tailed hawks. Those are northern birds. Some of those come as far away as southern Canada. But if you do that same drive in the hot month, you probably won't see a red-tailed hawk because they're just a very low-density breeder. but they're in big numbers and are in the colder months, and that's the same with the blue jay.
So while there are some resident, that most of this population is actually a migratory.
Right, yep.
How many of these birds that are migratory actually migrate to our area versus passing through like the hummingbirds?
Yeah, there's more birds that pass through than stick around for any part of the year. If you look at the numbers of shorebirds and warblers, and sparrows and other things, there are a lot that, maybe not sparrows, but certainly warblers and shorebirds I'm thinking of, that only are passage migrants and don't stick around. There's a whole bunch of them. But there's a large number of birds like what we mentioned that just spend part of the year with us. And then resident birds, we have a lot of birds that are resident. I mean, you see them in your backyard. The mockingbird probably doesn't go anywhere. The cardinal, the house finch, the Carolina wren, these guys are year-round.
I know my mockingbird that's still nesting outside of my bedroom window doesn't go anywhere, but he's still lonely.
Yeah, he's still singing at night, huh?
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we still have lines open and time in our show. 800-552-8502 is the number to call. That's 800-552-8502. So in terms of the migratory season, are we just about in the middle of it and the beginning of the return trip is getting ready?
Yeah, we're in the dead of winter, so there's not going to be a lot of stuff moving until, you know, spring migration is when we're going to see a lot. And for the majority of birds, that's going to be in April. But we'll see a lot of birds leaving us in March. A lot of our waterfowl will leave us before April. A lot of our wintering sparrows will leave us in late March, early April. So April is really when we'll see a lot of migrants. But until then, we got a lot of things that are here, and they're here for the winter.
And we are going to go next to Mark from Shreveport. Mark, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, you know, you were talking about red-tailed hawks earlier. And a chicken hawk, what is the scientific name for a chicken hawk?
Yep.
They're pretty aggressive. They kill ringneck doves quite a bit, mourning doves. They even attack my pigeons from time to time.
So, yeah, chicken hawk is a colloquial name, and it can fit a lot of things. I thought I saw a chicken hawk. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Foghorn.
Foghorn, leghorn. Well, the chicken hawk is typically associated with the red-tailed hawk, but, you know, there are people that see a Cooper's hawk after their chickens, and so if it's eating their chickens, it's a chicken hawk. But a lot of old-timers call the Cooper's hawk a blue darter. So blue darter is a colloquial name on the caliber of chicken hawk. But I'm guessing that red-tailed hawk is what we're talking about. It's the chicken hawk.
Okay, but I know those things are pretty aggressive. I mean, those Cooper's hawk.
Yeah, they're aggressive because they're foraging. So I guess if you ever watch some bird opening up a seed or an acorn, they're pretty darn aggressive too.
Right.
When you're hungry, you're going to be aggressive, and when you're diligent as well. I think diligent might be a better word than aggressive.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Enjoy your show.
Okay.
A lot of interesting
cool
stuff.
Cool. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. Right. And we're going to go next to Jerry from Alexandria. Jerry, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
I actually have a thank you. On one of your past shows, you explained the sound that I was hearing across the road from my home at night, and I knew it was a bird. I didn't know what it was. You explained that it was a juvenile great horned owl, and mimicked it perfectly. Apparently, they're calling for their parents to still bring them food, even though they're capable of hunting for themselves.
Cool.
It was spot on as far as the information, and the sound was perfect.
Cool.
I was able to identify it, so I really appreciate it.
Good. Well, we aim to please, and we're going to send you the bill for that since we nailed it, right?
Thank you very much for that call. And we got one more call to get in. Rocky from Alexandria, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. There's a grayish bird that has black stripes on its wings. I work in an industrial area, and it almost sounds like a seagull. It has a little bit of a long leg, and their call sounds like almost like a seagull, but they lay their eggs on the actual railroad track rocks on the ground.
Yeah. I'm guessing that's a killdeer, and I think we have a call of a killdeer. Let's see if Bill can find it. We've profiled that one before. And it there. This is killdeer.
Yeah.
And they nest on rock, on gravel, on railroads, you know, parking lots, et cetera, rooftops even, gravel rooftops. So I'm guessing you had a killdeer. How's that sound?
That sounds great. There's a bunch of them out there.
Yeah.
Carry on and carry on.
Right. Right. So he says his name, killdeer, D-E-D-D. So cool. Killdeer.
All right. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Rocky.
Thank you, Rocky. And we're going to go next to Leon from Bossier City. Leon, you're our last caller tonight. What's your question?
Not really a question, just more of a pat on the back for such an entertaining and intelligent discussion and to share with the rest of us. I've been listening for several years.
Great.
And you all are doing a wonderful job.
Wow, Leon. Thank you so much.
Can I put that on my resume?
Wow. Yep.
Thank you, Leon, for that.
Very nice. That's a good way to end the show, too.
I like that,
Leon, you made our day, week, our month. Thank you, sir.
I look forward to your show.
Hey, thank you so much. And speaking of that, you might mention, Bill, about the next episode.
Yes, the next episode of Bird Calls is going to be taking place in March. It's going to be 1 week later than normal. It'll be on March 28th. So mark your calendar for that. And, of course, we'll be right in the middle of the northbound migratory season, so we'll have lots to talk about then as well. And, as always, we close out our show with a conservation note. And, Cliff, what do you got for us this time?
This episode's conservation tip is on the war with wild hogs. The wild hog, also known as the feral hog or the wild pig, it's a blend of the Eurasian wild boar, which was first introduced in the U.S. over 400 years ago, and the domestic swine, which farmers often released into the woods so they'd fatten up before harvest. Estimated at over 5 million individuals nationally, over half of which occur in Texas, wild hogs cover a lot of ground. Telemetry data show that a sow's home range averages a little over 1,000 acres. Between their numbers and large range, hogs destroy agricultural crops, pastures, commercial forest land, parks, athletic fields, and lawns. They do this by digging their snouts into the ground like a tiller in search of food. In the process, they root up and destroy native habitat and future habitat used by many of our native birds and other wildlife. Hogs also feast on acorns and other mast, which means they compete with native species like white-tailed deer and the wild turkey, which we profiled earlier in this episode. With their tremendous sense of smell and omnivorous diet, hogs can detect and devour the eggs or nestlings of ground-nesting birds like northern bobwhite, wild turkey, and eastern meadowlarks. Hogs can alter and ruin wetlands and water quality and surface waterways that threatens human health, including disease transmission of E. coli and swine brucellosis. Vehicle collisions on our roadways with wild hogs results in millions in property damage as well as human injury and death. In Texas alone, wild hogs annually cause $52 million in damage to crops and property. While hunting hogs won't solve the problem, since sows average almost 2 litters per year, with each litter averaging 5 to 6 piglets, it certainly helps to control them. Currently, scientists are researching other more widespread eradication methods that will hopefully become commercially available soon. So help fight the war against wild hogs in your area and on your property. Do it for the birds.
All right, Cliff, I want to thank you again for coming up this week and joining us for Bird Calls.
I enjoyed it. I really like Leon's final message.
There you go. Yep. I'm gonna have that mounted. You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and he is our resident ornithologist at Red River Radio, and he is also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he has been with them for, 17, 18 years now?
It'll be 20 years in March.
All right.
Yep.
This has been Bird Calls, produced by Red River Radio. Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford have been your producers, with help from Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Robert Murphy tonight. The audio for tonight's program will be posted shortly on our website. Stay tuned. Radiolab is coming up next, and this is Red River Radio, your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. We are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria-Pineville, KBSA El Dorado-Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin-Nacogdoches.